nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Today I will be talking about finite size scaling and quantum criticality. My name is Sabri Kais and I am professor of theoretical chemistry. And my main interest in electronic structure calculations, quantum phase transitions. Let me show you the next one because this summarizes the research group. Our research focuses on two projects, one in quantum computing and quantum information theory, and the other project on finite size scaling or quantum phase transitions. And today I will discuss with you the topic of finite size scaling in quantum phase transitions. So I will start with the introduction. What is finite size scaling in quantum mechanics? And then use the theory to describe stability of matter in general. And then talk about stabilization in external fields like magnetic or laser fields. And then at the end, I will discuss a couple of open problems in this field. So let me start with phase transitions. I'm sure all of you are familiar with classical phase transitions. If you look at the typical phase diagram, pressure as a function of temperature, and you have the three phases, gas, liquid, solid. If you take, for example, a piece of solid and heat it, you go through the phase change, solid, liquid, gas. And the way to explain these phase transitions is by heating the system so you have thermal fluctuations. So the transitions are driven by thermal energy fluctuations by heating the system. So this is what we call classical phase transitions. What about quantum phase transitions? Quantum phase transitions are transitions at the absolute zero of temperature. If T equals zero, there is no heat in the system. T is zero. If T is zero, and we still observe phase transitions, so the question is what's causing the transition at the absolute zero of temperature? And if you go back to quantum mechanics, is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is the driving force for quantum phase transitions. When you localize the particles, you have momentum fluctuations and the momentum fluctuation causing the transition. For example, if you start with a Wigner crystal, imagine you have localized electrons on this lattice and the temperature is, we talk about very low temperature, few millikelvins. Now, if you squeeze this lattice, the momentum fluctuations will take over and you have a transition to Fermi liquid. So this is one example of a quantum phase transition at the absolute zero of temperature, where the Heisenberg is the driving force for the transition. So our interest in the field of quantum phase transitions. So let's go back again just to remind you of the a typical phase transition in classical statistical mechanics. So if I examine, for example, the pressure as a function of temperature, or here T as a function of density, so you have, like for example here, you have this three critical point where you have three phases, gas, liquid, solid. They coexist at the three critical point. Now this point is a critical point where you can move continuously from the gas phase to the liquid, which means you have here one phase. So one interesting question in this field of phase transition, we ask what is the coexistent or the shape of the coexistence curve, this one, near the critical point. So for that, you have to define an order parameter. Order parameter is a physical quantity which will change when you go through phase transition. For example, an order parameter for a typical fluid phase diagram is the density rho plus rho minus along the gas and liquid. Now, near the critical temperature, TC here, you can characterize the system by a critical exponent beta. So if you measure this critical exponent, you'll find it 0.327. Now, what is important about this critical exponent? This is universal. It doesn't matter what are details you talk about. You always see that near the critical point, you have this critical exponent. If the system belongs to some universality class. Now, in the classical phase transitions, we have six critical exponents, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, eta, and nu. These exponents describe the nature of the singularity near the critical point. Okay? So, for example, alpha is the way the heat capacity diverges as T minus T critical with the exponent alpha. Beta for the order parameter, and so on. With these six critical exponents, only two are independent because we have scaling laws that connect the different exponents. So if you measure two, you know the rest of the critical exponents. So you can characterize the critical phenomena by measuring two critical exponents. Now, you can collect all the critical exponents from different experiments. These are the experimental values for the critical exponents. And these exponents from many different fluid system and magnetic systems. So you'll see you have universality. The same critical exponents, doesn't matter what is the system. So these critical exponents do not depend on the microscopic lengths of the system. You have universality here. So these are the critical exponents. This is the theoretical value from the scaling laws or the relation that we described before. And now you can come up with model system to explain this exponent. For example, if you take a mean field type of theory, they don't really explain the experimental critical exponents. But for example, if you take a spin-Ising model in 2, 3, or Heisenberg model, you'll see the Ising model, which is a lattice of spins interacting in three dimensions, you see the exponents can be explained with this model. So to summarize this table, we have experimental universal critical exponents for all systems, and one can use model system to talk about these exponents. But Ken Wilson, back in 1982, developed the renormalization group techniques to directly calculate these exponents. And we know for his theory, he received the Nobel Prize back in 82 for developing the renormalization group, which will allow us to understand the universality of the exponents and how to calculate them. So again, if you have any questions, please ask them. Because this is a review of the classical critical phenomena. Then I will talk about the quantum one. So in classical statistical mechanics, the field of phase transition and critical phenomena is well known and well described, and the theory back in 82, and he developed the theory in 72, the first paper. It's a well known, and we know how to explain the universality of the exponents in classical statistical mechanics. Now, recently, there is a lot of interest in the quantum phase transitions. Do we have universality as we have in classical statistical mechanics? Can we come up with a theory to explain or calculate these exponents? So the theory to summarize the main idea behind the theory in classical statistical mechanics, people use the finite size scaling. What is finite size scaling? It's a systematic way to extrapolate information from a finite system to the thermodynamic limit. Why we need to go to the thermodynamic limit? Because the singularities that we talked about before, the transition or the existence of phase transitions is associated with singularity of the free energy. And these singularities occur only in the thermodynamic limit. This is a famous theorem by Young and Lee from 52. In order to get a true critical points, you have to go to the thermodynamic limit, which means you take the system, the size of the system to infinity. So if we do a computation in a computer, no one can do simulation on an infinite system. So you have to cut your system at certain size. So if you're doing calculation or doing experiment in a finite size, you will never see the true critical points. So you need a systematic way to extrapolate the information from a finite system to the thermodynamic limit. And finite size scaling is the way to calculate this point in classical statistical mechanics by calculating the system in a finite size, then increase the size of the system. So let me just give you an example. Suppose I'm calculating the heat capacity of a given system as a function of temperature. And this point is the true critical point. If I'm doing calculation in a finite system, I will see this kind of Gaussian type behavior where this maximum is here. So this point, we call it a pseudo-critical point. Now you increase the size of the system to n prime, n double prime, you see you are moving toward the true singularity or the true critical point. So finite size scaling will allow you to extrapolate information known from n, n prime, n double prime, all the way to the thermodynamic limit. This is n goes to infinity. So let me just summarize what we have in classical statistical mechanics. We talk about phase transitions and the way we describe it in classical statistical mechanics. I'm sure you have done it in the statistical mechanics. You take the system, you write the partition function Z. By taking minus KT log, you have the free energy. And then you investigate how the free energy changes when you change the coupling constant K. So this could be external field, temperature, and different parameters. And you can, within the phase transition field, you can ask about the criticality near the critical parameter. For example, the correlation length diverges with the exponent nu. Now, when we go to the quantum limit, the T goes to zero. Then in this limit, the free energy becomes the ground state energy. So instead of investigating what happens to the free energy, we're going to do it for the ground state energy as a function of parameters. Now remember, this parameter couldn't be the temperature because T is zero. So what we have in a quantum system, you could have external fields, magnetic field, and I will show examples of laser field, or the disorder in the system, the density. You can think about any parameter in your system, which if you change it, you might have a phase transition and the energy will change. And for example, a critical phenomena which is equivalent to the correlation length is related to the mass gap, where mass gap, this is the gap between the ground and first excited state. And the gap closes or open if you have a phase transitions. Now I describe both finite size scaling and classical statistical mechanics. Our idea is to develop a finite size scaling for quantum phase transitions. And you will see in a minute how this works, but just to connect the two ideas, in quantum mechanics, the size, we are working Hilbert space. So we're doing calculation in quantum mechanics is the Hilbert space. So if you take your Hilbert space to infinity, then only in this limit you can see singularities in the ground state energy. So our analogy is between the size of the Hilbert space and the thermodynamic limit. This is where we generalize the theory from classical statistical mechanics to quantum statistical mechanics. And you'll see in a minute how this works in a quantum system. So just I would like you to remember that the size that we are talking about now is the size of Hilbert space. And then we'll talk about applications. But let me just draw some analogy between classical and quantum systems. Formally, with using Feynman-Bath integral, we can show that any classical system with d plus 1 space dimension is equivalent to a quantum system in d space plus time, where the time is the imaginary time. So if you talk your quantum system and let this quantum system develop along the imaginary axis or the imaginary time axis, this system is equivalent to the classical system in d plus 1. So what we need from this table, not the, just like here, the free energy that we talked about is equivalent to the ground state when you take the limit. And temperature could be any coupling constant in the system. And the correlation length, which diverges at the critical point, you could have it the mass gap. If the system go from insulating to conducting material, the gap open or close, and you can see the transition in the quantum systems. So if you have a new theory and you'd like first to show in a simple example how this works, you have to make sure your example or the model is a simple model, capture the main physics of the problem, and in this case belongs to some universality class. So usually you have seen it a lot. If you in quantum mechanics, you have a new theory, then they show you how this works for the harmonic oscillator. And if you're doing statistical mechanics, whenever you have a theory, they first show how this works in the Ising model, just to give you an example. Now, what about electronic structure? We talk about here electronic structure calculations. Do we have a simple model that we to show you the phenomena of phase transitions? And usually in electronic structure for atoms, we have three exactly solvable models. The Thomas Fermi, this model when you take number of electrons to infinity, you can solve it exactly. You can have also an exact solution for non-interacting electron model where the nuclear charge goes to infinity. Or dimensional scaling model. Dimensional scaling, you take the dimensionality of the of your space and increase it. If you take D to infinity, then this is this limit becomes a very simple and you can get an exact solution. And I'm going to show you how the theory works first for a dimensional scaling model. So what is dimensional scaling? Dimensional scaling, we take your system, the Hamiltonian, and generalize the Hamiltonian to D-dimensional space. So you take each vector and make it a D-dimensional vector. And this is the column. So this is column 1 over distance, where distance is a D-dimensional vector. And this is the electron-electron interaction. And the kinetic energy, you sum over N electrons and sum over D space dimension. So at first, you see this is a little bit complicated because instead of working in three dimensions, you go to D-dimensional space. But actually, when you scale it, and you look at this Hamiltonian in the scale space, you can divide this term into two. One is the radial motion, and one has to do with the centrifugal motion. And you will see after scaling that the radial motion goes like 1 over D. D is the space dimension, 1D over square. So when you take the limit, D goes to infinity, you get rid of all the radial motions. And what you end up with, a simple model that the energy is just a minimum and effective potential. You have an effective potential, no motion. All the electrons are localized in this D-dimensional space. So all we have to do is just like take a function and minimize it. And if you minimize this function, you have the first term, which is the solution of the Schrödinger equation at the large D limit. Now, if you would like more accurate results, you can do 1 over D expansion around the large D limit. But I would like to show the phenomena of relationship between symmetry breaking and phase transitions from the large D limit model. And then if you are interested in more accurate results, you just take more terms in 1 over D expansion. So let's just take an example of two electron atoms. And I'm going to show the analogy between symmetry breaking and phase transitions. So if I look at this model, in average, the distance between the electron and the nuclei R1 equals R2. Now what happens if I change the parameter in the Hamiltonian, which is the nuclear charge? By reducing the charge, first you have symmetrical configuration, R1 equals R2. Now remember, in quantum phase transition, we're changing parameter in the system and we see what happens to the energy. Now I'm changing the nuclear charge. So look at what happened. You have a single minimum here. You have, this is the global minimum, and the dashed one is the local minima. If you further decrease the charge, you end up with a situation where you have three equal minima. Now this is both are solid lines. Now when you decrease the charge, you hit a point where you have a critical point. Critical point means you break the symmetry. Now this becomes a local minima, and this structure is global. So if you continue all the way down, you go from a single minimum to a double minimum, and you break the symmetry when you change the nuclear charge. So let us just look at the typical a Landau approach for phase transition for macroscopic system. This is fluid, not talking about electronic structure. This is, could be any order parameter. This is a typical fluid or magnetic system. And just like, I would like you to remember what we have. We have a single minima, and we start developing local. We have three equals minima, and you break it to double well. This is the phenomenon at the large D limit. Now look at the area. In this typical, this is a typical phase diagram for a fluid system. Before we talked about electrons, now we talk about any typical fluid system. So here we have a single minima in the phase diagram. You start building a local, and you have three equals. So this is a line of first order, and this is a three critical point, and this is a line of second order. So you can see what happened with the phase transition, with the breaking the symmetry, is you can map it to this free energy phase diagram of a Landau approach. So somehow we can associate breaking the symmetry of electronic structure with typical phase diagram for a fluid or a magnetic system. And then you go through the details. Of making, now, because I would like to show you this one so you can see what I'm talking about. Now, I can take the nuclear charge in this two electron atom and think about it as temperature. And if I take the external field and think about it as order field, the ground state, the free energy, the asymmetry parameter is an order parameter. You can define the critical charge and get exponents, critical exponents that I've talked about before. And this critical exponent, beta, alpha, delta, and gamma, you see the exponents. You get the same exponent as in a mean field. So when you break the symmetry of electronic structure configuration, you end up with the same criticality as if you do it for fluid or a magnetic system. So this is the analogy I'm talking about between the two, the classical and the quantum. So with this simple model, we show that symmetry breaking of electronic structure maybe use this point, resemble phase transitions in classical statistical mechanics. So what we have so far? We have a large D picture. You can say, oh, we live in three dimensions. I don't really care about large D limit. Okay, so now the question, can we carry out this analogy to the physical space, D equals 3? And if we succeed to do that, what are the physical consequences of this theory? I mean, suppose we have a theory for critical phenomena, and we have this analogy. Can we use it to do something useful out of this theory? And you will see the theory can be used to explain the stability of matter, and does it matter? I mean, atoms, molecules, extended system, quantum dots, all can be explained with this kind of analogy. So let's get back to our final scaling in quantum mechanics. So I said we're going to map the thermodynamic limit to the size of Hilbert space. So if you're doing quantum calculations, you know what to do. You take your wave function, you expand it in a basis set, and if your basis set is complete and you go from zero to infinity, you said, oh, now I have a complete basis set and my wave function is an exact wave function. And only in this limit I can see singularities in the free energy. But since we cannot do infinite expansion, we have to cut the expansion at some order m. So when we do this calculation with M, this means I'm taking my Hamiltonian and diagonalize it in a finite matrix. So the size of this matrix is the thermodynamic limit. So let's just go a step further and see how this works. So if I have a Hamiltonian where the potential depends on a parameter, I take the wave function expanded and then use finite scaling from classical statistical mechanics where the average, the basic idea is the following. In finite scaling, you say the average of any thermodynamic quantity with size n is related to the one at infinity by this scaling function. And we have to prove at the end this is the right scaling function. So if you do algebraic manipulation, and this is like a typical exercise when you do it in a renormalization group techniques, you end up an equation where the fixed point of this is the critical point. So at this point, let me give you an example. Here's the Hamiltonian, Yukawa type potential, a short range potential, the kinetic energy, and this is the short range you call what time potential, e to the minus r over r. And lambda is a parameter which will allow you to go from bound to continuum, and you break the symmetry of the system. So you choose a basis set. For example, here we choose a Laguerre polynomial times the spherical harmonics. It's a typical basis set used for solving spherical problems in quantum mechanics. So you take your basis set, you take this Hamiltonian, diagonalize it in this basis set, and start increasing the number of basis functions. N. Okay? And look for a fixed point. And here, what do you find here? So gamma is related to the Hamiltonian and the derivative. So if you arrange it in a way that you read directly, you read here the critical point, and on the y-axis, you read the critical exponent. So this is just a simple algebraic formula to read both the exponent alpha for the energy and the critical point using one plot. So what we did, we increased the size of the basis function from 4 to 100, and you see the crossing. Here is the critical point. So this is what I'm talking about in finite set scaling. We start with four functions, and we increase the basis set up to 100. And as we described before, if there is a critical point, there is a fixed point in this formula, and you will see it if you change the number of basis functions. And now we said, okay, suppose I do not would like to work with Slater type orbitals. Suppose I have Gaussian or other basis functions. If you have other, if you would like to change the basis function, there's no problem. You will see it. But the question is, if you have Gaussian, we might need more basis functions to get to the critical point. So it has to do with the convergence. For example, to the critical point here, 1 over n. So this is the Slater that I showed before. If you change to Gaussian, the rate of convergence, it's much slower than the Slater type. So you reach the critical point by changing basis function. There is no problem. But the question is if the rate of convergence will be faster if you choose the right basis functions. Now we go to back to data collapse and show that this function allow us to scale because we assume that this function allow us to extrapolate information from finite n to the infinite size Hilbert space, infinity here. In order to show this is the true scaling function, you can reorganize the terms and see how the function, if you put here the Hamiltonian, where the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is the energy, and this is what will be n. If I rearrange it and plot the energy times this n as the argument of this scaling function, do we have one function which allow us to extrapolate all the information? If this is true, then we have a scaling function. And this is what happens if, for this problem. If I have energy times n, and this is the argument of the function, and you will see for different basis functions from 50 to 100, all fall in one curve, which means truly I have one scaling function which allow me to extrapolate the information from finite space to the infinite Hilbert space. So this is the same way you do in classical statistical mechanics, except now n here were basis functions. Before, people do data collapse for size, number of particles. They do calculation taking 1,000 particle, and then they increase the size. And then they check if you have universality by looking at the data collapse, if all fall in one curve or not. Now we can ask, what happens if I have a finite matrix? If I have a finite matrix, then we don't have the true critical point. We have, you will see the parameter is a complex one. For example, if I take four functions and see what are the critical points for four functions, you see it's in the complex plane. But when increase the number of basis functions, you go to the true critical point on the real axis only when you go to infinity. And this is the same happens in Young and Lee theorem. By doing finite, if you do the as a function of temperature, if your system is finite, number of particles finite, you will see the true, the critical temperature in the complex plane. And when you go to the thermodynamic limit, what this is what Young and Lee show back in the 50s, to go to the real axis, you have to go to the thermodynamic limit. So let me just summarize. If you are familiar with quantum mechanics, when you take complex angular momentum and use the Reggie theory, we can describe scattering amplitude in quantum mechanics. And when you take complex time, it's all complex analysis in quantum mechanics. If you take complex time and use the instanton method, we can talk about tunneling. And we take complex energy and do complex rotation, you can describe resonance in quantum mechanics. And now we can add one complex thing to the quantum mechanics, is taking the charge to be complex and do variational calculation, you can talk about stability. And this is what I would like to describe now. So just to summarize, if you allow the charge to be complex and do variational calculations, we can talk about stability of matter. And this is the contribution from finite scaling to this analysis. So let's see how we describe stability of atoms, for example. I show you the results for two electrons. If I calculate what is the critical charge for binding two electrons, it turns out the critical charge is 0.9, which means all atoms and ions above are stable, below unstable. So since we don't have elements below, so we know hydrogen accepts an electron, H minus, this is the hydrogen atom plus an electron, and helium. So these are with two electrons. So the way we do calculation, I don't repeat it, it's a finite size scaling. You write the Hamiltonian, you write the basis function, and you look for fixed point. So let's just move to the... And just repeat again the analogy before I talk about stability of larger system. So at this point, the analogy that we are drawing between fluid, like going liquid gas, here's the free energy as a function of temperature, the entropy, and the heat capacity. And in analogy with the going from bound to the continuum, you lose stability. If you have an atomic system, you lose electrons. Or if you have a molecular system, the system dissociates. This is what I'm talking about here, stability. So this is bound continuum can be, can you think about it as you go from liquid to gas? And you see if you draw the energy as a function of lambda, any parameter, you'll see the same for energy, for the first derivative, which is the entropy, and the second derivative is the heat capacity. So there is an analogy between this phenomena of stability and liquid gas transitions. So two electrons is a small system, so let's go to three. If you calculate the critical charge for three, you'll find here 2.8. For four is 2.85. So if you calculate the critical charge for the whole periodic table and look at the y-axis is the surcharge, the difference between n number of electrons, and this is the charge as a function of number of electrons, you'll see this kind of oscillation. They are related to the electron affinity. Electron affinity is the energy for attracting one electron to the atom. So the difference between n minus 1. So this is the n minus 1, n plus 1, and E of n. So what are the conclusions from this? You'll see the maximum here, we have 1.5, which means you can attract like 1.5 electrons to a given atom in the gas phase. So the conclusion from the first calculation that in the gas phase, you will never see stable doubly charged negative atomic ions in the gas phase. Because the critical charge from these critical phenomena will not allow you to attract two electrons to any given atom. So maximum you have one electron with a given atom stable in the gas phase. You will never have doubly charged negative ions. So all doubly charged negative ions are unstable in the gas phase. That's what I'm saying. This theory will help you to analyze stability in general terms. The experimentalists knew that there is, but there was no theory to explain it. So experimentalists knew because nobody found any doubly charged negative ion in the gas phase, but there was no theory how to explain this kind of stability. But from the critical charges, you will see the electron-electron repulsion is larger than the attractive forces to the other electrons. and you cannot have double. So now the question, what is the smallest object that can bind two electrons? And we know we have to go to larger systems where we talk about molecular systems. And when we did the calculation, it turns out that two electrons will be stable for any given system if you separate them by around 5.6 angstroms. So if you take a system with this kind of size, 5.6, the system will be stable. So first we look at cylindrical symmetry. We say, okay, the electrons, they have to be far away by around 5.6 to have a stable system. So when we know this fact, then we can search what are the systems that they have this kind of dimension. And it turns out that beryllium C4 molecular system is the possible candidate for being the smallest object that can bind two extra electrons being stable. Now, when you go to spherical objects, we know that C60 accept only one electron. So 60 with one extra electron is stable. But C60 with two electrons are unstable system. So when we did our theory, we found that the criticality is around this point here, C79. So when we search the literature, it turns out that C84 experimentally is stable. So at least we are happy to see the theory is in between two experimentally known facts, that this is one electron and this is known to have two electrons. And the transition somehow around this C79. So only with, also with large objects you can explain the stability by calculating the critical parameters needed for binding in electrons. Now what happens if I have three body system like this with different charges and masses? And analyze the system in terms of two parameters like the ratio of the charges and the ratio of the masses. And the interest in this was, go back to the positronium negative ion. Here we talk about two electrons and one anti-electron. This is the same mass but different charge, E plus. So how do you think about, how do you analyze the system? Do you analyze it as a molecular system where you fix the position between the two electrons and let the anti-electron moves around? Or you fix the anti-electron as heavy one and those are moving around like an atom? Because an atom, you have the nucleus and the electrons around it. In a molecular system, you have the protons and the electrons around. And this was a big question, and people thought this is maybe more like a molecular system, like an atom. And remember, all the mass are the same. We don't have heavy proton and one is light going around. We have the same mass of electrons. But this is with different charge. This is minus and this is plus. So when we build the phase diagram for all three particles, so this is the ratio of the charge and the ratio of the mass. And you can take any three particles in the world, from electron, proton, any mass and any charge. So you can read directly from this phase diagram, we calculate the curves by finite size scaling. So for example, if you have two electrons and a proton, you have helium. If you have two protons and one electron, you have H2+, and so on, many particles in between. So it turned out that this positronium negative ion is we have two branches, one atom-like and one molecular-like. And from this critical phenomena, it's very clear that the positronium looks like a molecular system more than an atomic system, because there is a transition line here between two stable phases. So the other point, like you can read from the ratio of the charge and the ratio of the masses, what kind of particles you will expect to have in nature. And we can find like many stable forms, like E plus, mu plus, A minus, plus minus. And this system or this combination are not known yet experimentally. So at least we can tell the experimentalist, if you have three particles with three charges and three masses, they could be stable or unstable if they have certain ratio of charge and certain ratio of mass. And what happened at the border between the transition is what we call the Coulomb explosion. So here we look at the probability of fixing two and what happens to the third particle. And when you're getting close to the critical point, you have Coulomb explosion. You see the sizes. We talk about 100 atomic units, where the size of the system is in 1-2 atomic units. So you have a Coulomb explosion at the critical point. Now we can repeat this for other system. Like suppose you said, I have a dipole moment with charge plus minus. Can I capture electron? And we can do the analysis, get the fixed point, and calculate the critical dipole moment for capturing one extra electron. So you can say all system with the, in the world with the dipole moment larger than one, you can capture an extra electron. We can repeat it with the quadruple systems. With the charge minus Q half, Q and plus Q half. And we get a fixed point with the finite scaling, which means I can tell you exactly what is the configuration for capturing one electron or two electrons. Now let's just extend it to a larger system where here we talk about hexagonal lattice of quantum dots. Now each quantum dot, this is a simple model using Hubbard type Hamiltonian, where each site you have four states. So we talk about electrons occupying these sites in a quantum dot. You could have no electrons or one electron up with a spin up, one electron spin down, or two up and down in each quantum dot. And now we talk about this one, for example, with external pressure, squeeze it and see if we can describe phase transitions in these kind of extended systems. So the model Hamiltonian we use, the Hubbard type Hamiltonian, we have two parameters here. Is the T is the hopping between nearest neighbor and U is the on-site interaction. So we can use this model, and so if you would like to do a calculation for this one, it's extremely difficult because by the time you have 19 sites, you always have, I mean, you can calculate the number of configurations. You're going to reach billions of configurations by the time you have 19. Remember, when we talk about configuration, you have four states for each one, and you have to permute the spins up and down, two or empty. So by the time you go to 19 and you got to fill all the electrons, you have 2 billion states. So this is going to explode by the time you have another layer of quantum dots. So what we did, we used renormalization group techniques, which is a way to reduce the dimensionality of the system by grouping hexagonal lattices, hexagonal blocks together. So this is one block. So we can think about this one as one point. And now each block will be one point with an effective interaction, and keep repeating this until we reach a system of this kind of configuration. Now this configuration with the effective interaction, we will simulate the large lattice. So renormalization group is a systematic way to reduce the dimensionality of the system. From this, of course, we're taking into account the symmetry, the hexagonal symmetry. You can go from this one to an effective Hamiltonian for this one and do the calculations. So for example, you can see here the metal insulator transition at this point by changing the ratio over U over T. And when you do finite size scaling analysis, you see the critical point here is the fixed point. So let me just talk about now the last subject I would like to mention is the stability in super intense laser field. But before I start showing the results, for example, we have to define what is super intense laser field means. Okay? So you can see this is the typical diagram of the intensity we can reach with the years. And this is very impressive because now in the lab they can produce a laser with intensity about 10 to the 19 watt per centimeter square. So now when we say strong, sorry, we mean that we're comparing the laser field with the field produced from the air by the electron and the proton in the first Bohr radius. So if you examine what is the intensity for this one, electron and proton on the Bohr radius, and do the calculation, the intensity is 10 to the 16. So any intensity larger than 10 to the 16 is super intense because you break this interaction. So one atomic unit, when we said laser, super intense laser field, we mean intensity larger than one atomic unit, where one atomic unit of intensity is defined as the intensity produced by the electron and the proton in the first Bohr radius, which is 10 to the 16. So we talk about intensities larger than 10 to the 16 watts per centimeter square. Now, as we've described before, we need some parameter to change, but this is a very complex theory. So you have to describe, first of all, a time-dependent Schrödinger equation for the interaction of atoms with the electromagnetic field. But we can do a couple of approximations to simplify the problem in a way that we can do the finite size scaling calculations. By taking the moving from the lab frame to a moving frame along the motion of the electrons. So the electrons are going to move with the field, with the direction of the field. And along this field, we are solving the Schrödinger equation. So all we have to do is just shift the position vector r by alpha, where alpha is related to the amplitude of the laser field and the frequency. So you do a couple of approximations, and this is, if you are familiar with the laser atom interaction, it's called high-frequency Floquet theory. And you can turn the time-dependent Schrödinger equation to a structural equation, time-independent, by taking the Coulomb field to be an average an average field. So what we call the Drist Coulomb is the time average of the shifted Coulomb. You take the position vector r and shift it by alpha and average over a laser, one laser period. So we can take the complex time-dependent equation to a structural equation where the energy change with alpha zero. Alpha zero is the ratio between the amplitude and the frequency of the laser. And so this number is the parameter we're going to follow and see how the system will be stable by changing alpha zero. And she here is the expert in these computations. So if you take a just to see physically what happens, if you have one electron, this is like hydrogen wave function, and you look at the alpha equals zero, there is no laser. So this is one electron with one probability here, one with a wave function, which is the same. When you start increasing the laser field, look what happens. You split the wave function into two. It's just one electron. So physically what happens, like usually when we teach ionization, we said if you have an atom and you shine a laser, the energy, the electron will be excited and you ionize the electron. So if you look at the ionization rate as a function of the field, this is what happens. You have ionization rate will go up and up, but with the interesting thing will reach a limit. When you start working with super intense laser field, the electron comes back. So the electrons leave and then come back with the laser. And this is what people didn't see before. Before we say, I mean, we teach like this is you have ionization, this kind. But if you keep really looking at what happens if the intensity is large, the electron comes back and you have a bound state again. So actually the electron, look at the dimension of the hydrogen atom. We know the hydrogen atom is one Bohr radius, one atomic unit. And look at this. It's like between minus 50 and 50. It's a 100 atomic units. 100, the size is larger than the hydrogen atom, and the electron is going back and forth with the laser field. So people start thinking about, because before with the quantum dots, they use it as an artificial atoms. You can manipulate the quantum dots to produce artificial atoms. And now the thinking of the new direction is to manipulate these atoms with laser field and think about artificial atoms with the laser field. Because with the laser, you can move the electron. The electron is moving with the laser field. You see, I mean, this is really an important new direction of in atomic and molecular physics, where you can engineer this with a super intense laser field. So actually we did, I mean, this is the way potential looks like. So we did calculation, for example, for this is the probability of finding the electron as a, this is the direction of the field. And you look at this, helium minus is unstable, but it becomes stable in the laser field. So we can stabilize two electrons, and we have four with the helium. You know, in nature, we have helium only with two. And now we can produce artificial helium with four electrons. And when we have circular polarization, look at this, you can now, it depends on the laser field. If you, instead of linear polarized laser field, you go take circular polarization, you can reproduce artificial atom of this kind with four electrons. So that's what I'm saying. You can think about artificial atoms with laser field now. You can manipulate it, add the electron, move the electrons around, change the shape of the atom with the laser. So now I have this kind of atom with four electrons sitting where I know before in nature there's no helium, all helium exists with two electrons. So it's kind of an artificial helium with four electrons. And then the interesting thing, which we're still working on this, if you think what happens to the atom in a laser field, you saw the wave function will split into two. So if you think about the helium, you have the charge two and two electrons. But when you split it in the laser field, like you have like two half and half charges with one electron, it looks like a molecular system. So we think in a laser field, you can start with atoms and form a molecular system. So helium in the laser field, you can think about it as H2. So we can start thinking about building molecular system from these artificial atoms by, there's no difference between helium in a laser field with two charges sitting here and here and one electron and molecular systems. So the helium goes like the H2. So let me give you a summary at this point. We started from a large delay bit by showing that symmetry breaking of electronic structure resemble classical phase transitions. Then we told quantum phase transition can be used to explain and predict stability. So then we talked about atomic dianions are unstable in the gas phase, but they are stable or multiple charge stable with super intense laser fields. And let me just quickly mention the couple of few problems that we are working on in the group now is to combine finite size scaling with ab initio and density functional theory to go for large system or large, we talk about here materials and under different conditions, combining finite size scaling with the finite element method and think about new classification of chemical reactions, finite size scaling for Efimov states and stability of matter in super intense laser field. And also there is another project which I forget to, we just started, is to take this system into a solution. When we talk about old gas phase, and the question, what happens if you have working in a solution? And Paul is trying to talk about the stability of negative ions in a solution. And of course, I would like to thank many students that contributed to this research and the couple of agencies for funding over the past couple of years. And thank you for your attention if you have any questions.